If anyone would follow me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. An excerpt from Acts 16, having received this order, he put them in the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, trembling with fear. He fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds, and he was baptized at once, he and all his family. Then he brought them up into his house and set food before them, and he rejoiced along with his entire household that he had believed in God. But when it was day, the magistrate sent the police, saying, "Let these men go." And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Therefore, come out now and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us publicly, uncondemned, men who are Roman citizens, and have thrown us into prison. And do they now throw us out secretly? No. Let them come themselves and take us out." The police reported these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Roman citizens. So they came and apologized to them, and they took them out and asked them to leave the city. Only a few excerpts from our faith traditions, from our civil tradition and history, that address the questions of rights and responsibilities. I sit on the board of directors for the Hutchinson Community Foundation, and recently in grants committee, we were reviewing an application for funding to establish a tenants association in Hutchinson. And, you know, I'm generally in favor. I think that's a good idea. I think well-educated tenants and well-educated landlords are better for everybody. And I think that tenants deserve somebody to help advocate for them when they are powerless in the face of unscrupulous landlords. As a property manager myself, I do have some opinions about some of these issues. And I commented in the discussion, as we were trying to decide what we were going to do with granting funding here, said, you know, I'm in favor of the idea. I think the tenant association needs to be formed. And I've noticed that when we interact as property managers with tenant advocates, they are typically much more concerned with their rights than with their responsibilities. And as soon as I said it, I thought, aren't we all? So that's some of the genesis of this evening. And I'm looking forward to hearing from several different people. Anthony Miller, Eric Beachy, and Wayne Liebold have all agreed to share their thoughts and perspectives of rights and responsibilities. So this is what I sent them as I asked them to share this evening. It said, a prompt could be, share with the group how you think about rights and responsibilities in this stage of your life. How do your rights shape your responsibilities, or vice versa? And this is the piece that I want you all to hear before any of them speak. I said, giving yourself permission not to be completely right or balanced. How do you think we as a group should think differently about this? So if you hear something that might not be right and might not be balanced, that's actually what we're looking for this evening. So I think at this point I will take your announcements, and then we will get started with Anthony. What announcements do you have?
Competitor dog comes over and takes the bone. Both dogs know that somebody's rights been violated. They're very conscious of it. In the Enlightenment, free thinking of man was a big issue. It's obviously not the first time that's been a thing in history, but the Enlightenment kind of reinstituted that basic right. Along with that understanding of that right comes a responsibility then. If you have the ability to make a choice, you also have the responsibility to use that choice well. We think of even in war, when a soldier is operating under direct orders, if he is given an order that goes contrary to human rights and is a violation of human rights, he is responsible to not go through with that order, even though he is under command. So in the Minor Prophets, there is judgment pronounced against Israel for letting rich people extort the poor and the stranger, trampling their rights simply so that the rich could line their pockets. Jeremiah 5:28, talking specifically about the wicked men among Israel, says, "They've grown fat and sleek. They know no bounds in deeds of evil. They judge not with justice the cause of the fatherless to make it prosper, and they do not defend the rights of the needy." The Bible seems to blur the line a bit between rights, as we usually think of them, and responsibilities. They go hand in hand. The Ten Commandments. We have, "Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal." Basically, don't invade other people's sovereignty. But first in the Ten Commandments are several laws about coming under the authority of God and recognizing that it's only under the authority of God and under the community around us that we even have rights to enjoy. The authority of God provides security in the long run. In the short run, it may not also always feel as secure. I think of the story of Job. So Job has his things taken away from him, one after the other, all in a single day. First, his camels and donkeys are stolen, his sheep get consumed by fire, and then a tornado comes and kills all of his children. Moreover, his health is taken away, and to top it all off, he has a wife and friends that give him terrible advice. And he laments bitterly. But what I like to highlight is that in the end, even after all his stuff's been taken away and his personal sovereignty has been violated, he still chooses to put his trust in the Almighty God and chooses to believe that God is sovereign. And at the end of Job, we have Job being richly rewarded for putting his faith in God. And so some of the things that stood out to me about the story of Job were, we're all mortals and we have limited understanding. And so even when it feels like things aren't going our way and our rights feel like they're being stomped on, it's still right to trust in God. Additionally, we have the responsibility to be grateful for what God's given us. Without gratitude, the world becomes a pretty bad place. In the New Testament, Jesus goes further than the Old Testament laws supporting rights, specifically the rights of other people, not my own rights. He says his followers actually care about other people rather than simply caring about the things that I consider to be my rights. in Matthew 5, says, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever will compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away." And he goes further and says, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemies. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust." Jesus' kingdom has a dramatically different outlook on your personal, first of all, your personal rights. You're supposed to be able to give them up. Even when somebody takes away your cloak, you're supposed to give them your other cloak. Like, what's up with that? You're supposed to love your enemies rather than hate them. It's the principle of goodwill instead of retaliation. And it comes from a sense of knowing that in the end, God will make all things right, and choosing to rely on him in that way. Ecclesiastes distills it down very narrowly. Ecclesiastes 12:13 says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." That's pretty simple in theory. Jesus says similarly in Matthew 22, when he's asked by a lawyer, what is the greatest commandment? He says, "Jesus said unto him," the lawyer, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets." So he fleshes it out just a little bit more. Loving your neighbor is how you love God. The sermon last Sunday talked about faith and some of the heroes of faith and the way they responded to God, and it prompted action in their life. And afterwards, I was thinking about it. I was like, that's great, but how do I know it's God speaking to me and not, you know, my own thoughts or last night's supper speaking to me? And then I thought of back in CBS, Elam had kind of a way of thinking about it. He basically posited, as we spend time in God's word and as we think about and reflect on the character of God and what he's done in the past, it develops the mind of Christ within us. And then out of that, well, first of all, when I spend time with God, it gives me peace and assurance. And then out of spending time with God and developing the mind of Christ, I can then act intuitively out of that knowledge, because it's within me. Which is great, but there are times when I'm not going to think about, you know, all the things I should think about in order to, you know, direct my mind in the right way. In the story of the flood, illustrates that there are going to be floods that come into your life, and they're going to knock you off your feet unless you're prepared for them. And so how do you prepare for a flood? Could be, you know, sickness or death of a loved one. It could be depression, losing a job. In the story, Noah is warned by God of the impending calamity, and he prepares the ark to save his family. And I think it's fair to compare Christ to the ark for us. So the solution is to rely on Christ. But how do we go about, you know, actually putting our trust in Christ? I think we have a responsibility to our community and to those around us to help each other steer towards that goal, that higher calling. Without the support of friends and family, in times of crises, we'll be like Peter, taking our eyes off of Jesus right when we need him the most. So I think we owe it to those around us to stay close-knit and to not be distracted and kind of go off onto our own ways. St. Clare of Assisi wrote, "We become what we love, and who we love shapes what we become. If we love things, we become a thing. If we love nothing, we become nothing." Imitation is not a literal mimicking of Christ. Rather, it means becoming the image of the Beloved, an image disclosed through transformation. This means we are to become vessels of God's compassionate love for others.
Thank you, Anthony, for sharing those thoughts. I would love to just close the meeting and go home now, but we won't do that. One verse I would like to give as a backdrop to what I will share is in 1 Corinthians 13, otherwise known as the love chapter, verse 11. "When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man or an adult, I put away childish things." About the age 13, I transitioned. I transitioned from being a child to being an adult, and I've spent nearly 23 years as an adult. Now, you might have a different number as to when someone actually becomes an adult. That's perfectly fine. But my daddy gave me my adulthood, and that's the number I'm using, the number 13. And so as Shane approached me and talked to me about this topic on rights and responsibilities, immediately I thought of a few key concepts in my life that I feel helped teach me rights and responsibilities. And this is very much a practical portion that I'm sharing here. I think Anthony gave us the scripture for it. Looking back on that gift that my father gave me, I find it was a very important step in acquiring rights and in maintaining and fulfilling responsibilities. We owe it to ourselves to offer some definitions, even though they might seem obvious. So rights are freedom to act or to be treated in a certain way. And I think also a key component of this is they're almost always given to us by another person or organization. And the responsibilities, of course, are our response. The way I define it is our response to our rights. Now, there's a little bit of chicken and egg argument here. Do we have our rights because we've proven ourselves responsible, or do we have our responsibilities because we have rights and we need to act in a way to maintain those rights? Many times we grow into or gain rights in our responsibilities kind of by osmosis, meaning rarely is there a marker or a delineation between not having a right and having it. And for some things, maybe it doesn't matter. For example, the first day at a new job is frequently marked more with paperwork than it is a formal recognition of rights and responsibilities, although some of that, arguably, is in the job description and is part of the interview process. The acquisition of a driver's license is similar to this as well. For children and young adults, the most common form of delineation lies between not attending school to attending school, and then attending school and leaving or graduation. Yet when it comes to a ceremony or a ritual to mark the end of childhood and to encode rights and responsibilities into young adults, American society and culture has, I would argue, nothing. Oh, we have ceremonies marking the passage of time and movement in and out of institutions, most notably seen in school ceremonies, baptism, and marriage. But what I see lacking in society is initiation. Other societies around the world have this, and I could give examples, but for the sake of time, I won't. But this initiation wasn't always missing in American culture. And I'm, as an outdoorsman, I'm thinking of one in particular, so bear with me if I'm a bit on a soapbox, although I think Shane gave me permission to do so. That is the tradition or the custom on the American frontier for a boy, age 12 or 13, sometimes that varied, would often receive a rifle when he turned 12 or 13. That gift or that act was more than just getting a new possession. One thing it symbolized is he's now considered an adult. He is looked upon to provide for his family. There was no Dillon's or Walmart back then. And also to protect his family from wild animals and unfortunately from American Indian attacks as well. I think we know where we stand on that last one. So I'm kind of using that a bit as an example of initiation, and we'll hone into that as well. Now, you might ask, how did this come to be part of my life? And I'll explain that, but I do need to talk about three ideas or phrases that were frequent in the Philip Beachy household that I grew up in, and then also give you a little bit of background on my father. So the three phrases are, or ideas, are the age 13, roots and wings, and he or she is 21. That last one will require some explaining, and I'll do so when we get there. In the early 2000s, Time magazine wrote an article on tweens or tweenies. Now, today that's kind of a commonly understood word, and we know what's meant by that, but at the time it was a new word, and it intrigued my father when he read the article. That term refers to sort of a time period between childhood and adulthood, and again, experts will, I mean, look for a definition, and it's a bit vague when it starts and when it ends. But generally considered, this time frame is generally considered to be a bit of a no child's land, where societally there's not much expected of a child in that time era. Now, this confirmed a little bit of what my father was thinking on responsibilities, trying to help his children enter adulthood. And I should say that this happened also as some of my older siblings were past the age of 13. But for my father, he was the fifth boy in 6 years in his family. And so there was times in his life where he felt he didn't get the appreciation or the affirmation from his father that he wanted. And he also read a lot of books on the American frontier. And so somehow this idea of a young man at the age of 12 or 13 receiving a rifle and that kind of being a way of encoding the rights and responsibilities of an adult into that person's life stuck with him. And so he was trying to think, how can I as a father mark this transition for my children and do so in a way that encourages them towards adulthood? And so he did not want us to be stuck in our tweenie era. He wanted us to grow into full adulthood. And so for him, So at the age of 13, we were considered adults. We weren't physically adults, but he considered us adults. And he told us, I see you as an adult, I will treat you as such as well. In my eyes, you are invited into my adult world. And he deliberately asked us our opinions on things around the house. And I can relate a story where I keenly felt that gap between my lack of knowledge as a boy and his larger expanse of life wisdom. But he deliberately asked us for our opinions and treated us as such, as adults. He often said, if I can trust you, you have the keys to anything I have, but ruin that trust and your privileges or rights are shortened. And additionally, as youth, we never had a curfew. Sure, there might have been some explanation for why we were out later than normal, but he never said, you must be home by a certain time. That was a freedom he gave us. So that's a bit of the atmosphere surrounding that. Additionally, And this, some of us siblings look more forward to this than others, but when we turned 13, we were no longer spanked. And yeah, we thought that was good. But instead, there were maybe more adult, there were different, a different set of punishments that were given, and a bit more along the lines of principle and less just, you know, punishment. Already mentioned we were considered adults, already mentioned the no curfew. But when I turned 13, I received from my father a Remington 870 Wingmaster. And that, not all of us children got that. There were only a few of us that did. But to me, being an adult is symbolized in that. And so encoded into that gift, not only now that I'm being seen as an adult by my father and mother, I'm also now expected to contribute to the family. Yeah, I'm not necessarily going to go out and be shooting for food for our table, but I have a right to contribute, and I also have the responsibility not to abuse that right or the power that I have. Likewise, it's also symbolic for how my father sees me. That gun I will never voluntarily part with, not because it's crazy expensive or priceless or whatever, but it's because it's symbolic of how my dad sees me. And it's something I'll forever treasure. The next phrase is that of roots and wings. Dad, this is a concept frequently talked about in from my father, and he said it was his responsibility to give us roots. Roots are values that can't be taken away from us. They give us something to anchor onto. Despite whatever is going on in our life, we always have something that grounds us and anchors us. And in the analogy of roots are the responsibilities, wings are kind of your rights. And as children, it was our responsibility then to live according to the values he taught us. And that was kind of how we were showing, we were passing the test, quote unquote. And once we had our roots, we could then spread our wings. We could experiment with desires and things we were interested in. And we metaphorically and physically grew wings as well. Oftentimes, our house was more like an airport. Now the last phrase, he or she is 21. At first glance, this might seem just a touch derogatory, especially if you would have listened in on our conversations around the dinner table and realized the person we're talking about is maybe 25, 28, whatever. And it's in our house that it wasn't derogatory. What it meant was at 21, we were given our age, or we were, you know, fully considered to be on our own. And again, it was a day much looked forward to in our household. But what that meant, practically speaking, was you bear the responsibility of your decisions. Mom and dad, they couldn't tell you what to do, but they could advise. And so that's where the phrase, you'd be grumping about a sibling, and mom's like, well, he's 21. Basically, he can do what he wants, and if something goes wrong, the responsibility lies with him, not with you. And of course, bearing responsibility wasn't something that just sort of like poof came about when we turned 21. You know, there were throughout our teens, there were moments where we experienced greater and greater responsibility for our actions. So those three, being considered an adult at age 13, roots and wings, and being 21, or that being symbolic of I'm now an adult. I have the right to, quote unquote, live how I want, but then I also have the responsibility for whatever my actions bring about. When I think about rights and responsibilities, that's what sticks in my mind. And Shane gave us the prompt of how do you think we as a group should think differently about this, about rights and responsibilities? I'm not sure we do too well with encoding rights and responsibilities in some kind of ceremonial fashion to our young people. And again, age can vary. You might put it at 10, someone else might put it at 15 or 16. I'm fine with that. But some marker that indicates you are now moving into the adult world. We now consider you as adults, both from a family perspective, I think that is key and vital, but also I think it's helpful to then also bring in the community into that as well. It doesn't have to be the entire church, for example, but having some of the father's peers there as well can be very strengthening, I think, to a young person as they're making that transition. I think we can agree that there's an epidemic of fatherlessness in our society, and many young people are adrift with no purpose. They for sure see authority as not necessarily something to be embraced because they haven't been modeled an authority that loves them and cares for them. I'm not a father, but if I did have children, I don't know if I would differ much from what my father modeled when it comes to guiding them from childhood to adulthood. I would say that I was affirmed in who I was as an individual. I was affirmed affirmed into being an adult. I'm not quite sure how to phrase that, other than it was not something that was discouraged, but rather it was something that was embraced. And I was given increased rights while I proved my responsibility. So that's just a bit of my thoughts on rights and responsibilities. And again, going back to 1 Corinthians 13:11, when I was a child, I spake, I understood, I thought as a child, but when I became a man or an adult, I put away childish things.
Good evening, everyone. It is good to be here with you, and I will be sharing a slightly different than the other two brethren have. I'm going to tell you a couple stories, well, about three stories, I think. When Shane gave me this assignment, I told Shane that I have a responsibility to do this talk, but that at my age I ought to have the right to say no and not feel guilty. Probably within a half hour after talking to him, I wrote down a few things here. Responsibilities that I might have. And these are just thoughts. Be respectful. Be an example. Be prayerful. Be humble. Be kind. Be gracious. Be generous. Be friendly. Be courteous. And then I thought, well, I have to write some down for rights now. Well, the right to make my own choices, the right to be respected, the right to be treated fairly. And I kind of stumbled and stopped there. And I come up with less rights at the end of the day here than I did when I started the topic. The question is not if we have rights, but what we do when they are violated. How do we respond when our rights are stepped on? That's the key question. A large part of what shapes how I interpret my rights and responsibilities are based on how it will affect relationships. I have the advantage of looking back 70 years, and asking the question, what did I lose and what did I gain by not demanding my rights? Okay, this first story goes back quite a long ways. Our daughter was working as a maid for a couple with young children. And this particular morning when she went to work, it was very foggy, like just really bad. And she turned the lights on for visibility for the other people to be able to see her. And she got there, she shut the car off, but she didn't turn the lights off. And this was early in the morning, she didn't leave till late in the evening. The battery was totally discharged. There was no flicker of any light on at all anymore. So the gentleman where she was working came out with the jumper cables and put them on, but he had the cables reversed. Well, there was no juice in the battery at all, so he didn't realize that. And after trying unsuccessfully to start the car for quite a while, he discovered his mistake. So we took the car to the repair shop. It needed a starter, an alternator, a battery, and a computer. And they replaced those items, but it wouldn't start, still wouldn't start. And I don't remember how long that they worked on it, but they could not get that car to work. So they told me to take it somewhere else. So I did. I took it to shop number 2. They replaced the new battery, then it worked. I have no explanation. The shop didn't have an explanation, and certainly shop number 1 didn't either. Shop number 2 told me to take the battery to shop number 1 and get warranty for it. Well, I tried that, and at no time did I demand my rights. I simply said, here's the battery. They told me to bring it here because it didn't work. So he puts a tester on. Well, the battery tests fine. So I suggested, well, call the shop number 2 guy and see what the problem is. That was the wrong answer. The mechanic was very upset at me. He swore at me, and he said, I'll give you your money back. And then, if I would have just shut my mouth, I said, I want you to tell your boss to give me a call, or else you'll never see me again. That was my right. I never went back, and he never called. But that never felt good to me either. What should I have done? If I was given that opportunity again, I would have talked to the owner of the shop and would have simply left the mechanic right out of the picture. So what did I gain? A few dollars. What did I lose? Relationships. Was it worth it? With the advantage of 70 years to look back on, my perspectives have changed. Okay, that was story number 1. Now, story number 2 is a longer story. It happened about 15 years ago. These stories are 100% true. There's nothing made up about them. There's a story about my nephew, and I was going to call him a different name. I'm not going to, because I think he would say, you can say this story if you wish. About 15 years ago, Russ moved in with my wife Shirley and myself. He was a troubled young man. He was about 20 years old when he came. He lived with his parents in northern Ontario. He was about 7.5 hours north of where I lived. And it's a long story as to why he was in southern Ontario where he was. But he moved in because he needed a place to stay, and I invited him. And he needed a job. So that was the first thing I did, was help him find a job. And the second thing he needed was a car to get to work and home. He was 20 years old after all. Had never earned a car or owned a car in his life. So we went car shopping, and we found a vehicle that was satisfactory. He needed financing. How does a young man get financing if he doesn't have a job currently? We're trying to get a job. And he has moved from northern Ontario just weeks before that. Hadn't been at this current address for more than... Well, in fact, he hadn't even been living there yet at that time, but he was going to move. So, anyhow, about the only way to get money for that man was for me to co-sign. That, by the way, is a mistake. Don't ever do that. He wasn't good at handling money. This is his way of handling money. You could find it in every cup holder of every vehicle he drove, every pair of pants that went to the laundry, on the stair steps, and on his dresser. That's where you could find his money. And that's where it stayed. I had a lot of coffees with the money that he left in the cup holders of my vehicles. He loved having a good time. Went ice fishing, bent over, and his cell phone went down the hole into the bottom of the lake. And that's where it stayed. He had a bad accident, which did not make life easier for him. It wasn't his fault. He started working for a shop that put in garage doors and sold and installed garage doors, and he was on the crew helping put in his garage doors. One day he was on a step ladder, and this shop had an overhead crane, and I'm not sure what they're called, but it's the kind that is a I-beam on the one side of the building and another on the other side of the building, and then there's one all the way across. The whole thing travels back and forth. As he was on that stepladder, the crane operator was taking the crane up to the end of the building he was working on. The crane operator was not aware that Russ was on top of the ladder. The crane came, it grabbed Russ somewhere in his head, picked him up off of the stepladder, and there was a pinch point of 6 inches, and that's where his head was in between. The crane operator was made aware of someone being on the ladder, and he immediately hit the reverse button, and they said that's what saved his life. The crane stopped immediately and reversed right off of him. Otherwise, it would have coasted for a bit yet. It set him back on the stepladder, if you can believe it, and he, under his own power, came down the stepladder, went out to his vehicle, and drove home. Shortly after he was at the place where he was staying at that time, he was not able to walk anymore. He was paralyzed on one side. Now, luckily and thankfully, the paralysis went away, and he was able to continue working. For 2 summers, he went out to Western Canada. Yeah, not Western Canada. He went out west to help in the wheat harvest. Started in Texas, worked all the way up to Alberta, Canada. The one summer he got bitten by a rattlesnake. This is all the accidents that happened. And when he left, I told him that this could be a good experience for you, or it can be a bad experience. I said, you'll end up coming home smoking and drinking. Well, that's exactly what happened. Another thing, I think he was gone like 4 months. I don't know how much money he made in those four months, but he spent every penny he made. He didn't save anything. So you can kind of imagine what happens when you don't have any money in the bank at any time. Car payments are supposed to come out of there automatically, you know. You know how that works? If there's money there, it works great. If there isn't, it doesn't work at all. Well, there's one day we came home from, my wife and I were gone somewhere. We came home and there's a note in the mailbox. The name of the company was Auto Recovery. They make their living recovering autos or picking up vehicles that are not paid for. And they suggested that I keep the dog tied up. I suppose I should have had it tied up, I don't know, but he didn't like the dog anyhow. So he didn't pick up the car. Well, that made me aware that there was some problem. So I checked into it and found out that Russ had made about 1 or 2 payments on the car, and that was all. Never made any more. So this is responsibility for me now. Being a co-signer made me responsibility to make the payments. Well, I outright purchased the car then for him. He was out in harvest field and I couldn't get a hold of him. Well, when he came back from the wheat harvest, I found out in the second year he hadn't saved any money either. I should have maybe mentioned that he was supposed to pay rent at home too for to live with us, and that didn't happen either. I guess my rights being violated is a little bit what I'm trying to say. And of course, some of that, when you're a foster parent or when you're trying to help someone, you're responsible to try to help them make better choices. Well, I tried to help Russ set up a budget plan to manage his money. We went into the bank and talked a bit with the manager, and they gave us some literature and some forms and stuff to use. Yeah, well, his money was his right, and his right to use it as he wished, and that's what he did. One day when I needed fuel in my pickup truck, I told Russ to take it to the card lock and use my card and fill it up with fuel. So he knew that I had a card and worked great. So sometime later, I needed to fill up the pickup truck with fuel, and I did so. And for whatever reason, I put the card into the cup holder instead of putting it in my wallet the way I should have. Anyhow, the card went missing. And I think it was a month or two later that I discovered, according to the statements, that somebody was still using my card. So checking out the dates of when it was used and where it was used, it seemed to me that it was probably Russ that was using it. So I did ask him about it. No, he doesn't know anything about it. He didn't see it. And my wife one time asked him about it. No, he didn't see it. A little bit later in the evening, he asked me if I could use my pickup truck. He wanted to go away, and he didn't have a vehicle that was working at the time. So I said, he can have it. And I think it wasn't 2 hours later, the police knocked at the front door, and I wonder, what is going on now? Well, they said they picked him up. He had threatened to harm himself, and they picked him up and took him into the hospital. Russ's life went downhill. You know, it's one thing and then the next, and that's when we demand our rights, things go the wrong way. In Ecclesiastes 9, you read some words that indicate that you have a right to make your own choice. This is what it says. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O man, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thy heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for these things God will bring thee into judgment. And chapter 12, verse 1. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. My nephew had his rights. He enjoyed them, but they didn't last. After 3 years with us, he moved back home to his parents. I lost thousands of dollars trying to help him, along with many hours of time. What did I lose? What did I gain? That depends on which lens I look through. Monetarily, I lost thousands of dollars, but relationally, I gained a new friend, or a life friend. Through the years, Russ would always come back to talk with me. He wanted relationship, and it's still that way. Okay, so he moved back home to his parents. And he soon moved out again, too. He had his final fling. He moved in with a girl, and a short while later, they had a child. And then reality hit home. All of a sudden, they needed a house. He needed to provide. The bad habits learned while on the harvest crew demanded their rights: smoking, drinking, and parties. You know, we all have rights that we to make our own choice. We all have the right to make our own choices, but we cannot choose the consequences. Having a child helped him mature. They have two children now. He really likes his children, his two boys. He is very concerned about them, and if there's one thing that puts him into action is thinking of his children. About a year later, they got married, and I was invited to the wedding. Russell wrote his own wedding vows, and I was challenged. This is what he wrote. He said, "I may say unkind things to you," and that's talking to his wife, "and hurt you, but I will always love you." Now, you have to remember, his wife came from a very ungodly home. She had seldom been inside a church in her life. Her mother has problems and addictions and was not a good mother. So their marriage has been rocky all along, but it came to a climax 2 months ago. That's about the time that Betty and I were in Canada visiting. Some things came to light, and Russ told her, "I am done." He had got in contact with a lawyer and instructed the lawyer to write up divorce papers. And then my brother Ken, and Russ's father, and I went to see Russ. He works at a dairy farm, and he was working at the farm that morning. And we went over to see the farm and to visit with him. And then after our short visit, we were going to go back to my brother's place for lunch. Russ was going there too. And then Russ asked me to join him on the way back, so I did. Then he turned to me and he said, "Wayne, I have made some choices I'm not proud of. What should I do?" He said, "You probably heard about my wife and I." And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "What I said at our wedding, I meant." He said that he would always love her. That evening, Russ told his wife, "I forgive you." This man never forgave anyone. He told her to come back home. So they moved back in together, and things went quite well. 1 week after they moved together, while they were at work and the boys were at school, their house burnt down. They lost everything they had. There wasn't a toy left. There wasn't even a cat left. But the community, the local community, the local Mennonites up there, they all poured out to them. He said they have four times as much as they had before the fire. This man who never cried, he said he cries every night when he thinks of what the community did for them. He calls us almost every week asking for prayer. This is a man who didn't pray. In the last 2 months, Russ has made more good choices than in all the rest of his 35 years of life. And he is happier than he has ever been. He laid down his rights and picked up his responsibilities to care for his wife and children. He is currently thinking or making plans to send his boys to a Christian school next year. He is changing jobs so he can spend more time with his wife and boys. He's taking steps to ensure transparency between him and his wife. They need our prayers, and we hope the seeds that have sprouted will grow to bring forth an abundant harvest. And if you would ask Russ today what his rights are, he would tell you, "I don't have any." He is a changed man, making excellent decisions based on how it will positively affect his wife and two sons. He is committed to stepping into his responsibilities and laying aside his rights. Okay, and now I have one more story. I realize I'm taking a fair bit of time here. Livestock exchange. I suppose some of you probably know what I'm coming at here. We own a few sheep, and about a year and a half ago, there was a group of men that came in two different vans. They wanted to buy, they told me at first there was one sheep, which was not a problem. Then they wanted to buy seven. Well, that's okay too. We agreed on a price, $150 each. Then they slaughtered the sheep. They loaded the meat into the vehicles and they climbed into their vehicles. Then one of them remembered they should maybe pay for it. So they paid, but they declared they did not have enough money. They had $350 less than was agreed upon. And that's the way it was when they drove out the lane. Later we heard they were bragging to their friends about the good deal they got, and there was more to that story too, but do I not have the right to be treated fairly? What does God say about such dealings? You can look it up in Proverbs. He calls it stealing. What should I have I done? Yes, they got my goat along with my sheep. My rights were violated. But I do not feel that I disrespected them in any way. And I'm happy for that. I have a right to say my sheep are not for sale. So I will not sell sheep anymore. But I guess what I'm saying is the times that I demanded my rights, I did not feel good about it. But the times when I gave up my rights, God had his way. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for letting us see through your lens. Your perspective and experiences. And you know, one of the things that stood out to me as I listened to all three of you is that we can all point, and we all can, point to times where we think about what our rights are and what our responsibilities are. And in those moments, we all have choices to make. And what might seem right or responsible in a moment of time sometimes shifts with time. You know, the story of Job went through quite an evolution. Russ's life over a number of years, you know, shifted significantly. And the choices we make along the way regarding our rights and our responsibilities shape us and shape other people. So thank you again very much for everybody that shared. John, do you have a closing song for us? And this will be our closing.